Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. I am very pleased to welcome for a Van Eck fireside chat, Pranav Kanaday, portfolio manager at the Van Eck Digital Assets Alpha Fund. Pranav, great to see you again. How are you?
Good, man. Good to see you in New York after hanging out in London for a bit.
Yeah. So tell us about your journey. You now are a portfolio manager and investor in crypto protocols, but you didn't start out that way. How did you get into crypto? What's your journey?
Born and raised in India, I grew up in this town in Bangalore. My parents, who are doctors, decided to be adventurous, moved to the States when I was 12 years old, brought me with them. Went from Bangalore to like a small city in Connecticut, or a small town called Cheshire. Ultimately wanted to get out back to a bigger city, so I went to NYU for undergrad business school. I actually wanted to go to film school, but my parents said they were not going to fund my excursions in film. And hindsight, that was a good decision.
So investing and making good capital allocation decisions runs in the family.
Yeah, it's I guess it's a part of like Indian culture too. I'm Indian, obviously. I remember in high school into college, I was really into biotech stocks. And I was like, well, I kind of want to learn how to like value equities. And so that's how I stumbled into finance. NYU was pretty well known for having a great equity valuation course. This guy, Professor Aswat Damodaran's famous. Unfortunately, I didn't get to take his class, but I did take the valuation course with his mentee at the time and who was teaching the undergrad version of this. But that was by far my favorite course in undergrad. So I went to the undergrad business school, kind of explored a variety of different opportunities. I started freshman year at NYU a week after Lehman blew up. And every senior at Stern at the time was pretty depressed because all their banking jobs were going away. But thankfully, I was like, you know what? I have a couple of years to figure this out. So I explored VC. I explored, kind of business development at a startup, and ultimately stumbled into distressed credit. I took a course in debt. It was called Debt Instruments at the time. And I also took the equity valuation course. And I thought credit was an interesting place because you get to kind of look across the capital structure. Macro plays a little bit of a role into how you invest in credit. And you really get to look at the asset side of the balance sheet and say, what are these assets worth? And then you get to then also look at the other side of the balance sheet, the liabilities and equity, and say, where does kind of value sit? So it gives this more holistic picture of things. Started in the world of credit in 2011. I started my career at UBS on the distressed high yield desk, right during the European credit crisis, which was fun. I was looking at like Italian telcos. And it was kind of trying to understand how to underwrite an Italian telco distressed debt while you have sort of this macro restructuring type risk as well. And how do you sort of bake those things into your analysis, but also how do you sort of hedge some of those tail risks? So that's where I came into that world of investing. Went to the buy side relatively early. I was at a firm called Hutch & Hill for a period of time, I think 5.5+ years. I was a pretty young guy on the team. I was a TMT guy by background, but someone at the time told me to look at energy. I knew nothing about shale. I was pretty young. And so, I started to learn. This was like, I started learning about shale right when the boom started, where everyone was issuing a high yield bond at 7% to go drill somewhere. And they kind of gave you all these great theoretical economics of like, hey, it might take us, 2 years to recoup our CapEx, but look at these great IRRs on the other side and please finance this thing at 7%.
And Pranav, when is this? 2013, 2014?
Yeah, 2013, 2014. That's probably the right term. Yeah. And then sort of you did the macro math, which was, if I remember correctly at the time, the world consumed something like 95 million barrels a day of oil. Saudi Arabia was a certain chunk of it. I think it was like north of 10. OPEC was basically over a third of the market. And, obviously the US was just growing at an accelerated pace. You could kind of tell if something didn't give, i.e. OPEC didn't cut, the price of oil was going to potentially collapse. We didn't know when, we didn't know how. But one of the things we did at the time was sort of do this dispersion trade in our portfolio, which was you just bought high quality bonds and shorted low quality bonds in the oil and gas space, purely defined by like, what's your break even cost to produce a barrel of oil, all in shale. And the spread differential between the two was pretty limited. So you kind of had this great optionality that if commodity prices did correct for whatever set of reasons, then that quality differential would play out. And so we got right on that. We had the trade on, but we didn't know how it was going to work. And that ultimately worked because oil prices corrected. And then thankfully on the other side, we were able to find some interesting oil and gas assets to buy when oil went to $25 and every bond went to, you know, sub 20 cents. So that was, I was doing all of that. At some point during that period of time, I discovered Bitcoin and I'm weaving it back into crypto. It was probably 2015. And, you know, my brain just thinks of optionality, right? Like, what are some good call options at all times? So this oil and gas trade you're talking about, that was a call option of a trade. Bitcoin at times seemed like a call option, so I didn't think too much about it. I wasn't like a monetary policy guy. I wasn't like a dollar debasement guy or anything. It just seemed like an option. It seemed interesting. So bought some Bitcoin, didn't think too much about it. And then fast forward, 2017 comes around, our sort of oil and gas cycle trade has worked pretty well. Visiting my college roommate in Austin at the time, this guy, Kyle Samani, who runs a firm called Multicoin. Mm-hmm. This was before he started Multicoin. And so he articulated his crypto thesis then. I was intrigued. This was right during the ICO mania. And what was most interesting to me and got me excited then was this ability to use an asset, in this case, ETH, and essentially, you know, use people around the world could subscribe to ICOs, you know, ideas on a piece of paper. And it was all smart contract based. So, you know, you knew ahead of time what ownership you'd get in that project. And it was all sort of programmatic, did not require any investment bank in the middle, right, to facilitate any of those capital formation like activity. So that was unique and different. Everyone had sort of some great, interesting blockchain based idea they wanted to ship to the market at the time. So I started following crypto more actively then. Obviously, was very disappointed when those ideas that came as white papers never fulfilled their vision for a variety of reasons. So I decided, look, there's something special here. I don't really exactly know where it goes. I don't want to sort of build a career around this yet. I'm just going to allocate to other people and see how it goes. I continue to sort of do my distressed high yield credit job. I was at a firm called Angelo Gordon in 2019, just big asset manager, continuing what I do. But I started to allocate to crypto and just follow other managers. COVID happens and I'm in between jobs. I'm sort of transitioning from Angelo Gordon to Millennium. I had a garden leave. So I went down the rabbit hole on all things DeFi in that sort of 2020 timeframe. It was all just by, I had very little to do. And there was something interesting, again, happening in DeFi in 2020. DeFi was very different from the ICO wave, which again, got a whole new cohort of people interested in crypto again and people said, well, what is this about, right? Which is at the time, the key things people were doing was providing liquidity on Uniswap and then borrowing and lending permissionlessly on Aave and Compound. Obviously, then that created this massive boom and other DeFi protocols, people kind of tinkering with the same ideas. But that intrigued me again because, you know, I started my career on a market making desk and I understood the moat the banks had on providing liquidity, you know, trading desks, how profitable it could be. And here was Uniswap that was allowing people just around the world with assets to provide liquidity for assets. And then you can then extrapolate where all that could go. And so as DeFi started to take off, and then ultimately you had this wave of NFTs, or NFT as a category take off as form factor, and then how those two things were kind of intersecting, to me, the probability of crypto actually becoming mainstream one day went up because there were sort of interesting things happening beyond just capital formation, which was 2017.
All right, so Pranav, you come from background in distressed debt investing where you buy a bond for 60 cents, 40 cents, and you get that upside if it goes to 100 cents, but also you're kind of being short a put if it all goes bankrupt. So, and then you go to investing in Bitcoin where you export its payoff function to being something like a call option. Is there something different between selling puts and buying calls?
So I'd break up credit markets into maybe three buckets. There's investment grade, there's high yield, and there's distressed, right? So when you're buying an investment grade bond or a high yield bond, yes, you're very much selling a put, right? Because you're buying a bond at par, you're buying a bond at 90, has some coupon, you know, max you can make is your coupon plus some price appreciation, but really can go to zero. But default rate in credit is pretty low. So you're playing this probability game that you're not a complete moron picking credits. And like, if you get Enron, you get Enron, right? You can't manage for└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└└============└============└└============└└============└““░░░└└└└============└└className     ││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││││there are some assets or cash flow to some underlying business that creates sort of this intrinsic value. And then when you're buying something at 50 or 60 cents, you know your downside's limited based on that intrinsic value. So you're actually buying a call that a value appreciates and this thing actually behaves more like an equity rather than a piece of debt. And that's something similar, I think, with crypto, at least the space of crypto that I focus on. My team and I are hyper-focused on tokens that have a couple of very specific characteristics. One, the underlying product or project that the token represents essentially ownership around has to look like a monopoly. Because crypto in general, crypto projects in general are just generally open source code and anyone can copy paste your thing. So it's very hard to find projects that theoretically could be monopolies in the category they're in. The second component of that is we were looking for things that are monopolies that can have pricing power, where that pricing power ultimately flows to the token in some shape or form, which then creates that intrinsic value for it. And ultimately, what the asymmetric call option you're betting on is that most of these projects have maybe 1 million monthly active users max, depending on what you're looking at. You're betting that that 1 million monthly active user number is going to go to 100, 200 million in the distant future. So you kind of pair those things together. You have a call option with sort of this intrinsic value component embedded, which is very similar to what you have in distressed.
Got it. So yeah, distressed is actually not selling a put. So they are similar. That's interesting. Okay. So you said that you invest in projects that want to have a monopoly and presumably like capture the value that they create. I suppose an example of a crypto project that is actually very beneficial and people use a lot, but is, you know, struggled with the value capture would be something like Uniswap. What is a project that you've invested in that you think does have that value capture where, okay, people are using it, people are buying the Coca-Cola, and shareholders of KO get paid?
So we've talked about this publicly, again, not financial advice, any of this, but we made an investment in Helium. HNT is the token. I don't know if you know too much about the project, but essentially started off as an IoT network where they said to folks, plug in this little box in your house. And when you plug in this little box in your house, they will propagate service leveraging your Wi-Fi. And you'll earn some tokens for doing that. And eventually someone will, you know, build IoT devices to use that network that people have built. That didn't scale because they kind of had this classic problem of like you built this network, but then the demand never came. And so you had this ever inflating token supply. But they eventually, I would say pivoted, but they started building a mobile network on the side. So Helium Mobile is the plan, where a similar idea, which is folks plug in a little hotspot in their house. They earn some tokens for doing that. But then on the other side, people buy a mobile plan, the Helium mobile plan. I have one on my phone. I pay $20 a month to use it. Again, compare that to Verizon, AT&T, where folks pay, you know, $40, $60. I think the ARPU in the United States is like north of 100. So it's way cheaper than any mobile plan. When I'm using my cell phone in an area where there's no hotspots, it uses T-Mobile's network. But when it kind of goes into an area where there are Helium hotspots, it uses the Helium hotspots. Now, what's the benefit of routing traffic through Helium hotspots versus T-Mobile? It's a magnitude cheaper. So if you think about it, the mobile plan is run by a company called Nova Labs, just regular business. And on their end, they're trying to manage their cost structure, where if packets are going through the Helium hotspots, they're paying the Helium network. If packets are going through T-Mobile, they're paying T-Mobile. And the Helium hotspots owners are theoretically benefiting from the economic arrangement where that data goes through the Helium hotspots. So essentially, token supply of Helium or mobile in this case is going up. When pay packets go through the Helium network, cash flows come in and then they burn the token supply from data credit purchases from Nova Labs. And it sounds a little complicated, but going back to the question of what's the monopoly here, well, if you think about the moat, it's like a two-sided marketplace, right? On the one hand, supply, which is hotspots. On the other side, it's demand, people with mobile phones. And as both these things scale, it's very hard for someone to copy paste that. It's very hard for someone to come and disrupt that. So if mobile on a blockchain or mobile leveraging a blockchain as an idea takes off, this theoretically could look like a monopoly where there's very clear cash flow characteristics.
That's interesting. And is it still using what's called a LongFi, or is it using Wi-Fi?
I believe it's using a combination of CBRS and Wi-Fi.
Are we in a bull market in crypto?
Personally, I don't think so. No.
Really?
No.
Even though Bitcoin's up something like 300% and most stuff is up more?
Yeah, I think this time things are a little different. If you kind of look at historical bull markets, you have a Bitcoin halving, which then brings attention to Bitcoin. I personally think Bitcoin cycles are driven by demand, not necessarily supply. The supply is the catalyst to create demand. So we kind of did this internal research project on our team in trying to figure out what has the highest correlation of price. And it turns out it's just creations of new wallets that then buy the native asset. So if you look at the history of Bitcoin halvings, bull markets begin, you know, several sort of months after the halving. And that's because everyone starts paying attention to this asset that just went through sort of this halving of supply. And there's a demand creates the bull market in Bitcoin. But historically, what's also been paired alongside that is sort of like these new ideas on everything else that gets people excited on the possibilities. So again, 2017 ICOs, 2020, 2021, it was DeFi and then eventually NFTs and gaming. And you kind of put all those like things together, which then became GameFi, right? All these things, ideas got people really excited. I don't think we've seen anything that net new in the world of crypto outside of sort of this Bitcoin ETF. So the Bitcoin ETF to me brought a lot of interest back in from a demand perspective, but I don't particularly see anything that something that net new on this everything else category, which is where I live, that that could justify a true bull market.
And yet prices have shot up. Admittedly, they have declined a little bit. So you say for there to be a true bull market, there needs to be a new narrative, and we don't have a new narrative.
Not just a narrative, like we need substance, right? Yeah. So like the narrative this time around, the best one I've seen is like this idea around financial nihilism, which is, you know, younger people feel like they've been left out of this whole wealth creation thing. Housing's more expensive. Everyone's burdened by student debt, all these things. And they're just kind of looking for ways to gamble to catch up. And they're looking for like the next 100X. And you saw that in the first quarter of this year, right? The best performing subcategories within crypto, I would say, were meme coins, narrative coins, essentially things that VCs didn't really own and, you know, where like retail couldn't, there wouldn't be like natural sellers to these tokens. So retail said, we can go speculate on these things. Yeah, that speculative energy oftentimes is interesting, but it does not have like substance and sustainability to it, right? So we saw this with GameStop and all the Reddit stocks back in the day. It was a point in time and then it died. I'm sure there's other examples of this, but like these like lack of substance, like speculative casinos don't have necessarily running room. And so we need things with substance that gets people excited that then ultimately creates a real bull market.
In your investor letter, you talk about sort of fading the momentum and the bull cycle narrative and how you choose to invest in things that have a risk reward framework that you can actually measure. So what are things that you can measure that you like and invest in that way in a somewhat fundamental basis versus just chasing the flows into meme coins?
Yeah, so our framework for the asset class as well as our strategy is pretty straightforward, which is the entire space is still a call option. And our job is to try and pick the best call options at the right expected value. And so the way we describe that is essentially we're trying to, as I said, find projects that essentially look like monopolies and have clear economics and great teams and all these things. But the key to all this is sort of saying there's probably 350 million people in the world that own digital assets on some centralized exchange. The number of users of on-chain products in aggregate is in the tens of millions. So the call option is on this idea that the tens of millions will grow into 100 million plus.
Amount of people who have wallets, 350 million. The percentage of people,
a number of people who are on centralized exchanges that own some crypto.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
People who own crypto on centralized exchanges, so who own crypto but don't really use it, that's 350. And then tens of millions, so less than 10% of that, people who use it and who are digital natives, I think they're called.
Correct. Yeah, users of these products, right? Like the example would be like if 350 million people that people owned an Apple iPhone, but only like 20 million people used the App Store. Mm-hmm. So you're not really using the thing for its full utility. You're just kind of buying a financial asset. So the premise of all these things is that people use on-chain products and they will spend money to use on-chain products. And that ultimately then creates some value to these token assets, right? So for us, that's not a done deal by any means. We think there's a 50% chance that these products are adopted and there's a 50% chance potentially all these things can go to zero because nobody uses them and the industry doesn't figure out how to make these things usable and hit mainstream. And so we think purely in terms of probabilities. So when we look at a project that, let's just say, we hold a token position in and that token position has gone up by 10x, we then ask, has there been commensurate increases in fundamental KPIs. So every project is unique. You know, what defines success for, let's just say, a layer one blockchain like a Solana is very different from what defines success for a Helium, right? So there's no standardization on KPIs. It's like kind of like saying what's good for an oil and gas stock is very different from what's good for Apple stock, right? You measure those things very differently. So we, for every project, we kind of say, what are the right ways of measuring success? we think of it as binary. It's either like this thing's going to have zero users in 2 years, or it's going to have, you know, tens, twenties, hundreds of millions of users in 2 or 3 years. Then we ask, okay, there's been an appreciation. What is this thing worth in that sort of downside case? And what is it worth in an upside case? And then it's a probability weighted expected value analysis. So if I think something today is trading at, I'm making up numbers, $10, and we think in our bull case it's worth $100, then if we think there's a 50% chance it goes to zero and there's a 50% chance it goes to $100, there's an expected value there, right? So that's more the qualitative element, which is for us saying, has the probability of mainstream adoption changed dramatically in 6 months, or has it been a marginal improvement? And is the risk reward less favorable today than it was 6 months ago?
Let's go to a TradFi example. If the stock of ExxonMobil goes from $100 to $150, the fundamentals do not change at all. You could say, okay, this is maybe 50% less attractive because it's 50% more expensive. The fundamentals haven't changed at all. However, if your view, instead of XOM the stock, it's XOM the token, does the token going up actually validate or attract more people to invest in it? So it is kind of, the more it goes up, the more people want to buy it.
Yeah, actually, there's more nuance to it. There's sort of this reflexivity to crypto in general, which is as the price of something goes up, it's potentially more likely that people use the thing you've built. Let's give the Helium example, right? Because we were talking about this earlier. The way the network works is generally someone spends a couple hundred dollars buying these hotspots and they put in their house. And they earn token rewards for doing that. On the other side, if I buy a Helium mobile plan and I share my location with a network, I own some tokens as well because I'm providing them valuable data. They want to know where I'm using the network so they can encourage other people to put hotspots in those areas so the traffic doesn't have to go through T-Mobile, it goes through the Helium network, right? So if you think about it, as the token price in this model goes up, people's ROI on both sides of buying a mobile phone as well as having a hotspot is superior than it was at a lower token price, which then accelerates network adoption, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so there are several projects that have that mechanism where price appreciation can lead to accelerated adoption.
That makes sense. But then it also happens in reverse, right? With,
yes.
What was the game coin?
Axie.
What's it called? Axie, yeah. So yeah. Everyone playing the game, you earn tokens playing the game, the token goes up. Oh my God, my friends are now playing the game. And you do have this virtuous cycle, but when the token price goes down, a virtuous cycle becomes a vicious cycle. How do you navigate that and manage that risk?
This is where sort of asking a very critical question is important, which is the project creating value for users outside the token itself? So in Axie's case, in our opinion, that was more or less DeFi yield farming sort of, but in the context of gaming, right? So you have this little Pokemon looking thing and you're doing things with it and you're earning some tokens. The game itself, I would say I've never really played the game beyond like a very short time period. Other people have. They've generally said the game is not that much fun. So people aren't getting any utility beyond just the token farming itself. So the key here is like having projects that have a use case on their own, and the token is just purely an accelerant to driving adoption of the underlying product. So again, going back to the Helium example, the product is the mobile plan that is cheaper for the end user than a Verizon or AT&T. The token just acts as the accelerant to the adoption of that business model.
That makes sense. Yeah. So you are saying something which I have for a long time believed, which is that the product has to be good. Like the game has to actually be good, and then crypto can be a little boost on top of it. No one is going to change their life and dump their iPhone to buy some other phone because the token of the phone is going up. That's never going to happen. It can happen for individuals and even tens of thousands of people, but never for billions of people.
Yeah, and that's not sustainable either, mm-hmm. right? Because to your point, if the token price starts going down, then people don't want to do the thing. So that's the crux of a lot of what we do. And I think it's one of the things that we spent a lot of time the last few months looking at, because there's so many of these, let's just say DeFi projects on a variety of different chains, and even infrastructure projects in a variety of different chains that are doing this points airdrop farming game. And so you'll see a lot of users and TVL and quote unquote traction on many projects because people can earn some points, which ultimately might equate to some airdrop. But that is not sustainable in itself. People should be doing the underlying thing because they're getting a utility out of it. The utility could be entertainment, right? It doesn't have to be like I'm saving some money or saving some time. It's purely like people, consumers do things. Most of the things consumers do on the internet is like entertainment based.
Pranav, you have this really interesting diagram from your investor letter about the three types of investors, the three types of capital flows that are going to the space, how they're different, and also what they invest in is different. So there's institutional money, category one. Bucket two is crypto native VC, venture capital, and liquid funds money. You're a liquid token fund. And then the third is retail money. So tell us about these three different buckets and how is their investment philosophy different?
In that case, we're just kind of simplifying this idea that crypto as an overall ecosystem needs inflows, including Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin's still inflating in supply, and that goes to the miners, and the miners have fiat-based costs, and they have to sell some Bitcoin to manage that fiat-based cost. But if you look at everything, again, Ethereum is probably the only example or exception to this rule where Ethereum is somewhat deflationary, so there's not more ETH being created every day. But most things in crypto outside of ETH really is inflationary and has essentially a need for outside capital to come in. And so one of the things we do is we say, okay, there's basically three pools of capital, and really like that middle, like the middle pool is intertwined with the first two. But there's institutional capital, it's basically endowments, foundations, sovereigns, family offices, just the traditional pools. What is that interested in doing? Well, that money historically has either had no allocation to digital assets or has chosen to allocate to maybe Bitcoin and maybe some ETH. But the Bitcoin ETF has really been a catalyst for adoption. So that money has so far has started flowing to the Bitcoin ETFs. But that money has also now become intrigued with everything else beyond Bitcoin, right? Once you sort of buy some Bitcoin, you understand what it's about. Then you want to know, well, what is all this other stuff about? Is that interesting as well? And should I think about getting exposure there? And the way that money makes its way to that part of the world is through folks like us, VC funds or liquid strategies. And the way we allocate to assets is based on sort of what is fundamentally interesting, as in, again, goes back to that, what's going to take the 10, 20 million users to hundreds of millions that has sort of this killer app-like feature. And that really drives the core premise of how people like myself look at this world. The VCs obviously are doing a very different thing, which is they're trying to find the next kind of 100x type thing over a 3-year time frame from a less liquid perspective. The issue the VCs are battling with is these traditional allocators who are now looking at crypto. They've been sort of stuck with an overall portfolio that's become less and less liquid over time, because there's been less IPOs and less exits. Equity markets haven't been hot.
In the traditional financial market, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So when they look at their overall portfolio, they have to have a certain balance of illiquid and liquid. And, crypto VC is illiquid, and they already have too much illiquid exposure in their book. So they're looking for distributions from the previous vintages of venture funds so they can do more allocations there. That's the two things that are connected. And then there's retail that's very, very different, right? As I said earlier, the theme of the year has been retail coming in to try it at 100x. And given that sort of middle dynamic of what I mentioned, which is venture funds have not made big distributions, retail has kind of psychologically realized, well, I don't want to own things that venture funds are invested in, because no matter what, they are likely sellers at any price to make distributions so they can go raise their next fund. So retail decided to play a completely different game, which is I'm going to go do meme coins and narrative coins. The point of all this is to really get an overall picture of money flows and how those money flows are playing out, where is it ending up, and what kind of characteristics will create what I would say successful investable opportunities in the token space.
So you note that crypto native venture capitalists and liquid funds, money funds, invest in quote unquote smart VC backed altcoins. And you put the word smart in VC. Is it fair to say that a hallmark of this year has been the not smart crypto projects going up way more than the smart projects? And I guess that, traditional finance example would be like AMC going up while yes. Apple is flat.
Correct. Exactly. And that's more of a technical dynamic that people are becoming aware of, right? Which is that the quote unquote smart projects have this sort of sell pressure from vesting tokens from the investors of the last cycle, from the 2021 cycle. As you think about the retail money coming in, they're trying to hit 100x, right? They're trying to like sort of have these gambling like outcomes. And it's hard to do that in a coin that has sell pressure from VCs. So you've had this weird bifurcation in the markets.
that sell pressure just comes from FTV fully diluted value. Basically, there's so many tokens exist, but they haven't been sold yet. They're not on the markets yet. And you know, you have that in traditional finance when a company goes public, they sell $10 million worth of stock, but $200 million is still held by, you know, one family founder. So things can go up, move up and down. You have that in crypto, but you know, times a lot. I've got a question. Because there is no exchange, how do you calculate what is liquid and trading versus like if I held something and I literally never traded it, but I'm not an institutional holder, would that count as market cap or fully diluted value?
So if you are technically holding something in your wallet and you could trade it, like as in there's no like contractual obligation preventing you from trading it, that would count towards market cap. Simplest ways you can track this is you just go on the block explorer of the project and you see what the circulating market cap is relative to the total supply. And then you can go to their white paper and basically read what's the vesting schedule typically looking like, who's vesting how much, right? So most of these things launch as token projects, as let's just say as an airdrop, and vesting begins. So the airdrop tokens are immediately vested. People can go trade it. But for original investors and team, which ends up being, you know, 30, 40% of the overall supply, total supply for most of these projects, vesting will probably begin in 6 months. And it's oftentimes not a cliff vest because cliff vests are scary for people. So it's usually like a linear, there's a small cliff and then there's a linear vest on a monthly basis from there.
Got it. I think this is, compared to other topics in crypto, you know, easier for traditional finance folks to wrap their head around. Like, yes, you have stock grants and there is a selling pressure, but it is quite extreme. I mean, you've got a table of these token launches and their supply schedule. The most extreme one is WorldCoin, which is backed by Sam Altman, where literally less than 2% of the entire fully diluted market cap is publicly trading. So 98% of all WorldCoins will be sold by VCs or owned by institutional players that will have selling pressure. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I wouldn't completely say it's full sell pressure, right? Because we have no idea what people will do. Like, you know, mm-hmm. as folks vest, they might not sell, they might hold on. But here's what generally happens, which I think is unfortunate for crypto and people have to figure this out, is when you launch a project with a low float and you do this huge sort of marketing, you know, play around that, which is like, you know, every founder, when they're launching a token, they go on some podcasts. There's like sort of a lot of media content, a lot of hype. Low float then leads to people interested in your project at any price. And then you create this massive FTV, right? And so as folks vest, the magnitude of dollars of wealth creation on paper is so big that they will likely sell. I think one of crypto's biggest problem is how token launches are done, which is low float, high hype, which is across the board a thing that, you know, I think hurts the space.
When Bitcoin launched, it was the opposite. No hype and yeah. Everyone could have it. They were giving it away for free.
It's a fair launch, right? You have to do some work to then get some tokens and it slowly inflates. So you can manage sort of this dynamic of supply and demand somewhat reasonably.
You know, in your fund, VIP, NX Digital Asset Fund, you know, try and avoid these kind of products. And okay, if it's really good, we'll invest in a VC-backed product, but generally we try and, you know, avoid those.
No, I think it's just one of the components of the analysis, which is for most projects we look at, we kind of have a fair value relative basis to other projects and also on an absolute basis. In a market like now, like fair values are way below the absolute price of many things, right? Hence, you know, we are being conservative at this moment. But we also look at these things on a relative basis. And VCs vesting, teams vesting, and how much dollars of wealth has been created as those vesting events are happening is a big input on whether we invest in something, but also if we do, how we size that investment.
That makes sense. So I noticed that you raised cash, i.e. you've sold tokens. We record this in the middle of April, Thursday, April 18th, as we record. Roughly, when did you, you know, raise cash and sell tokens, and what motivated you to do so?
Without getting into too much specifics, you know, as I said, many token projects have appreciated meaningfully in price, but we don't think that's been justified by an equivalent adoption in the fundamental metrics and also the probability that these things hit mass adoption. So we just generally thought in Q1 of this year, crypto assets in general were mispriced. And we didn't know what the macro risks were that could reprice these assets, but we saw a ton of leverage in the market. You know, as you looked across various altcoins, funding rates were enormously high. The valuations didn't make sense from a probability adjusted perspective. So again, if we think 50-50 odds, something gains traction, but it's gone up in price by 10x, then it's that much less attractive. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So we looked at a set of factors and we said, it's just not asymmetric to be long crypto alts in general at this point. And we de-risked our book in Q1. And the way we de-risk is we don't short crypto assets. You know, we don't use leverage. It's purely going to stable coins.
So okay, you said that the leverage in the space was high and you observed that by funding rates. And I think that's something in traditional finance that you have to go back a while to see of in a frenetic bull market when everyone's bullish, borrowing rates actually go up because everyone wants to borrow cash to go long risk assets. Does that happen in crypto where, you know, you said the funding rates are high, that indicates everyone's bullish, everyone's borrowing money to go long crypto, and I'm going to, you know, ease on the gas a little bit, as opposed to during a bear market, funding rates are really low and everyone's talking about how great it is to earn 3% on stablecoins.
Yeah. The way you think about it in crypto markets in general is a predominant amount of leverage comes from these perpetual futures markets, whether on centralized exchanges or really decentralized perps markets. But most of it is like Binance, OKX, and Bybit. Those are the biggest perps markets that drive leverage. And the way those typically work is folks bring in stablecoins or some other large assets. They use that as collateral. They borrow against that collateral and they buy something on leverage, right? Simplistically, someone might come and bring in $1,000 USDC of collateral and buy $10,000 worth of Bitcoin. And when they margin or borrow that amount, they're paying a funding rate to the people who are essentially taking the other side of that trade or is providing liquidity for that margin. And so when funding rates get to levels, let's just say I'm making it up, an altcoin has gone up by 10x, everyone's really bullish, and all of a sudden people are now borrowing against other assets to be levered long this asset, and they're paying 30, 40, 50% annualized funding to own that asset. What they're basically saying is they're expecting that much of price appreciation above that funding rate to make a profit on that trade. Said differently, if the token didn't appreciate by that much in price, then the person is net losing money. So after price have gone up a ton, if folks are borrowing on these exchanges to be levered long something and paying that funding, you need a continuous appreciation in that price. Otherwise, you'll have a deleveraging event. So something bad happens macro that gets people scared, then that could trigger a pretty big deleveraging event, which is kind of what we saw the last couple of weeks with the combination of the war situation in the Middle East, but also the hot CPI print and sort of the Fed having to potentially get a little more hawkish than where they were.
And how do you think about how macroeconomic fundamentals, the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates, inflation is hot, impacts the crypto world? And do you think it's just, is there anything other than the same channels that affect the stock market? And, you know, I mean, the simple way of saying that is like Bitcoin is kind of like a triple levered NASDAQ.
Yeah, I personally believe that Bitcoin is viewed as a risk asset, especially by the folks that are coming into the space the last several months. I know this is kind of a big debate on whether, you know, people buying the ETFs are viewing this as a store value or a risk asset. And I would say people might tell themselves they're buying a store value, but they're really like feeling risk on when they're buying Bitcoin, right? If they're feeling like risk off, they're probably buying T-bills. So Yeah, I view Bitcoin as a risk asset. I view everything in crypto as like a bigger risk asset. It's venture risk with liquidity. While I don't make decisions in our strategy based around what's happening macro, you know, I pay attention to what's happening macro. It's really around sort of how frothy are conditions in the market. So, you know, it's an indication of people's risk appetite. And can that risk appetite change to the negative? And from time to time, when people's risk appetite is maxed out, like there's not that many good things that can happen in the world that can increase that risk appetite. There's only one way to go, which is worsening that risk appetite. That's when we sort of think it's probably a good time to play defense.
And so you played a little bit of defense and, you know, things have gotten defensive. Prices have retreated. Are you playing offense now? Are you still playing defense? How are you thinking about where your positioning in the market right now.
Yeah, so I can't fully get into specifics of what we're doing or thinking, but again, it goes back to our earlier view, which is so far we haven't seen anything terribly net new with a lot of substance that I think will get tons of people excited to come into the space. Now, there are pockets, right? To touch on a few pockets, there are some great things happening around payments. You saw PayPal a couple of weeks ago with PYUSD say they're looking to do, I think, gasless transfers, right? So PayPal's got the widest distribution. You know, I think that's an interesting area. Payments in general, stablecoin-based payments in general, is going to be sort of this snowball that is going to accelerate over the course of this year and next year. The second category has been in social. So I've personally become a user on Farcaster. You know, I've seen a lot of other crypto communities move over there. There's just unique things enabled by Farcaster that can't be enabled by Web2. So people are coming to use it for those use cases that are just new and different. We can get into what and why, but, you know, I'm just highlighting that. And then again, Deepin, you know, if you look at sort of Helium Mobile subscribers every month, they're adding, you know, tens of thousands of subscribers. So there's things that are gaining traction, but they're not like a hockey stick. So we're monitoring those. We like those things that are just sort of slowly gaining adoption because of, you know, real intrinsic reasons. But beyond those things, we haven't seen anything that net new that was similar to DeFi and NFTs last year or last cycle. And so our view here is like time to be patient and see as these things evolve and as something net new comes about that is that will likely get people excited for another bull market, you know, we will be focused on that.
You track daily transactions, number of wallets, and developer growth within the protocols. And I know, you know, you have some statistics about, you know, compared to last cycle, the wallets are three times higher, but the developers are less. Tell us about, you know, what exactly those numbers and what you glean from those numbers.
Yeah, so again, for each project, we have sort of a set of metrics that we think will define a bull case, right? And so if you're talking about a layer one protocol, very simply, it's the number of users on that blockchain using applications, paying gas fees to use them. And, you know, is the number of users growing? Are those people spending increasing amounts on fees to do things on chain? Or are they spending decreasing amounts? And then on the other side of it, are the number of unique applications coming onto those blockchains growing or decreasing? And then the key word there is unique, because there's a lot of like people coming in and doing small variations of what already exist on those chains. You want sort of new, different things. These things are petri dishes. We track all those things. Ultimately, we want to see increasing velocity. So more developers building more new and interesting things, more users coming in at a faster pace to do things on these chains, and existing users and those new users spending increasing amounts of dollars on a daily basis to do these things. That kind of shows us generally engagement. As you're seeing a lot of these assets appreciate in price, we're asking if the velocity of those factors are also increasing or decreasing or staying about the same.
If you don't think that the development is there and that the substance is there as it was in the last cycle, why have prices risen so much?
I think the short answer is Bitcoin ETF, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have this dynamic where still a vast majority of Bitcoin is held by crypto hands, folks that bought Bitcoin last year, the year before the last cycle, right? So if you have 19 something million Bitcoin out there, a decent chunk of that is held by people who are native to the crypto ecosystem. And when they experience a wealth effect as a result of these ETFs, they then take that wealth and they want to speculate, right? So, you know, if I have created $1,000 of wealth for myself in Bitcoin, maybe I'll take $50 or $100 of that and go speculate in different things. And that sort of has this natural lift up.
Got it. That makes sense. Yeah, I think the wealth effect in crypto is much bigger than it is in traditional finance. Like if Apple goes up, yes, some people sell their Apple and buy Microsoft. But in crypto, is it fair to say it's much bigger? And in particular, for individual protocols, like if you own a lot of Solana and then Solana goes up theoretically 20 times, which it, you know, it did, then you have all the Solana people have a bunch of money to plow into Solana-based projects.
Yeah, basically, right? But also, this goes back to the question of retail versus institutional capital in the crypto space. But crypto is still very retail heavy. And you know, if you're a fund manager, what you might say is, you know, if I have $100 of risk, maybe I'll de-risk $50 of it and maybe take $5 of it and go out the risk curve. So I'm still, you know, looking at it from a beta perspective. But a lot of times what happens is, you know, retail looks at it differently and says, you know, I made $1,000. I'm going to take that margin that and go speculate on something with it on margin.
Is it fair to say you're not bullish on meme coins?
As a category, I think meme coins will continue to exist and they will continue to garner more attention. Especially because I think meme coins are the new Vegas. My generation and generation after me does not want to go to Vegas with a bunch of their friends and go stand at a craps table. They would rather chat with each other on iMessage and speculate on the next meme, right? That's the version of gambling. So I think the TAM for meme coins is somewhat, you know, a mix of the casino industry and the sports betting industry. That's what it's really competing with. So I think what you've seen is, you know, a couple of big meme coins drive outsized returns for people. And as a result, there's been an explosion of the number of meme coins. I think you and I can create a meme coin right now on a platform in 5 minutes, right? Like, it's that easy to create a token and then try to create a meme around it. So I think you'll have the number of tokens continue to grow. But you, again, might have sort of this power law distribution where, you know, a handful of meme coins actually just kind of survive and keep living and keep driving sort of these mini hype cycles.
What do you think will be the ultimate killer use case for crypto?
This, again, as a domino, you know, you need one use case to bring people on chain and then other things will also get adopted. So there are a couple of those possibilities as I would think about it. Payments is a big one. You know, stablecoin based payments are just easier and better. It's actually funny. Like, we were supposed to wire money to a project a month ago, and the project was not US based. And like, it was just like difficult to send a wire out from our bank to like that international bank. And, you know, cause our wire kept getting rejected. And, you know, if I sent that payment on Ethereum on using USDC, that would have been done in probably 35, 40 seconds. So I think that is, someone's going to make this stuff a lot easier for people to use. You know, you're seeing traditional Web2 businesses just kind of leveraging those things. So payments could be one. It seems obvious. Social, I think, is one. Again, I talked about Farcaster earlier. I think it's interesting for people to go download the front end, which I believe is called Warpcast, and test it out. The interesting thing there is it allows me to do all the things I wish I could do on Twitter, which I cannot.
Like what? You know,
like, if I see someone talking about a stock on Twitter, I want to be able to just trade that stock in that UX. I don't want to have to go to my Robinhood app and then go trade that stock. Right.
Oh, really? So it's specifically built for, oh, so-and-so is talking about this. I want to buy this or sell this.
Yeah. Obviously, it's not enabled for equities right now because it's a crypto-based project. They have this feature called Frames, which anyone can embed a frame in there, which will allow you to do things within the app. So it's kind of really blending in social and what finance really is supposed to be. And sorry, I was going to say the two other categories was Deepin. The Deepin was one. And then the last category, Deepin was, you know, things like Helium that I've talked about. And then the last category would be something in sort of the permissionless market space. So, you know, it could be a combination of DEXs, but also perps markets on chain. You know, one of the things I was always intrigued about in 2017 was prediction markets. You know, at the time I wanted to buy some real estate, I believe in like Mexico. My only way of doing that was finding some ETF to buy it or actually going to a city in Mexico and actually buying a physical piece of real estate. I wish there was a prediction market where I could just get that financial exposure. And there's so many of these situations where you want to, you know, sort of bet on something, but there's no market for it. So permissionless markets where anyone can go create a market on one of these DeFi platforms, and then someone else can provide liquidity and earn the fees from providing liquidity for that market, I think as an idea, we'll take off. There's several projects we're focused on that are doing that. But I think there's some product market fit there. So those are the four kind of buckets, we think.
I don't understand, really know what Deepin is. I know a lot of people are talking about it. Could you explain Deepin to me as if I was 4 years old?
Yeah, it's simply taking infrastructure or things that exist in the physical world that are currently run by a handful of centralized companies and saying, can I recreate that service by crowdsourcing that supply? And as a result, the product itself is better, faster, cheaper to the end user. So Helium, as I mentioned earlier, was like a perfect example for it. You know, mobile services are now essentially controlled by four big telcos in the US, right? AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, and probably like a handful of MNOs that aggregate to number four. Can you propagate data packets by crowdsourcing that function? And as a result, having a cell phone plan that's cheaper for the end user. That's like the simplest example of it. There are people trying to do this in the GPU space, which is you want to run some inference jobs. Well, you have to go to Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and to get some NVIDIA H100 GPUs. Could you get independent data centers to cluster together their GPUs to offer a similar product and using a token incentive to aggregate that supply for the end user who's building some AI application? And for them, the benefit is that that compute is way cheaper.
Interesting. Can you share your theory about Tesla? Do you think Tesla could get involved with crypto?
So I actually had this funny, I have this Substack where I wrote about why Tesla should tokenize their equity and what the benefits would be. But and that was primarily centered around self-driving, which is Tesla's future isn't self-driving. I'm sure you've seen all the news, right? So like all the latest news with Elon saying, you know, the future of the company is in self-driving. I think a big problem for them is solving that sort of 1% edge case problem where like, you know, the self-driving thing might work 99% of the time, but like that 1% of time it screws up. That's a problem from a regulatory standpoint. Right. And the only way you fix that is with more data. And the most valuable data for Tesla is when someone turns on self-driving and then decides to disengage, because that's when the system learns a lot, which is why did the human kind of come in and intervene? What was the mistake that I made? And that learning is very valuable. But I think a potential problem for Tesla is folks don't want to turn on the self-driving in their car because like they're like, why bother? I like to kind of drive and I don't want to take the risk that something bad happens. So I might as well continue driving. Like my parents own two Teslas. I always tell them, can you turn on self-driving? And they're like, no, the car might crash, right? So my thought was, well, if people got a financial incentive, which is some airdrop of Tesla stock every time they turned on self-driving, then they might be more inclined to experiment with it. And the only way you can really do that is if Tesla was a tokenized asset on some public ledger, making the asset programmable. I mean, another kind of use case, I didn't even think of this, but it came up recently, because I don't know if you saw, but I'm a reservation holder for a Cybertruck. I've been waiting for like years and years. And I believe a few weeks ago, Tesla came out and said they're going to prioritize deliveries of the Cybertruck for people who own the stock, right? So They basically said, if you owned 500 shares of Tesla on I can't remember the exact dates, but basically if you own a certain number of shares of Tesla before 2021 and you continue to own it until now, AKA demonstrating you're a long-term investor, you have to send them brokerage statements and that would ultimately dictate whether you would get the product, right? If Tesla was an on-chain asset, they didn't have to do any of these send me a brokerage statement stuff. They could just check people's wallets and say, this wallet has held these shares for this much time. That's a loyal investor and I should reward them also as a consumer.
Do you think that crypto could benefit from incentive structures of holding assets and not just moving in from one to the other in that way?
Yeah, I think it just very simply taking assets, financial assets that are, essentially dumb assets and making them programmable, i.e., you know, having other properties beyond just represent an ownership has many properties like that or many features that could benefit the underlying business. So in Tesla's case, it could be as simple as like enabling more self-driving, enabling more loyalty, or just kind of blending the lines between user and owner. But, you know, for other companies, it could be something totally different, right? Like, you know, for McDonald's, they could try to encourage folks that own McDonald's stock to come and try different products. I can't imagine people that own McDonald's stock are also like big McDonald's consumers. So trying to increase.
But there is an overlap. Not as much as Tesla, but there is an overlap.
Yeah. I'm just making an example. But the point is like Every business is unique and making their sort of capital instrument a programmable asset has benefits for their underlying business.
Got it. So making a complete 180 turn, what do you think are some of the most common mistakes crypto investors make or the most dangerous ones, the ones that hurt the most?
The most common one seems to be people love to buy high, sell low. as in, I don't think they fully understand or underwrite their view on the asset class. So when crypto goes to a bear market, they just full on dismiss it. When prices go up, they conflate price appreciation with adoption and they ultimately feel FOMO and they come in. So I think what I tell everyone that I talk to who's interested is like really understand what you're betting on with this asset class, like, you know, which to me is hundreds of millions of people using applications on public blockchains. And understand what the path of that looks like and have ways of measuring, is your thesis playing out or is it not playing out? And have that dictate how you invest in the space rather than price as an indicator of anything.
Is that what you would consider investing discipline?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about the venture capital, your thoughts on the venture capital world and their investing discipline.
I think it's a big mix. I think there are some great high quality VCs in the space that have been around for several cycles who continue to get some of the best deal flow because founders have seen them help other projects be successful and they want to work with these VCs. The general problem with those older generation of VCs is size. They've gotten just potentially too big. So while their success might have been a function of them first being a $40 million fund and writing small checks into early stage projects and giving outsized returns, that's now led them to have much larger funds. And as a result, they might not be able to really continue writing those small checks or sort of, you know, having the bandwidth to write those small checks. So that's kind of problem number one. Problem number two is in 2020, 2021, you had this sort of new cohort of VCs that came into the space. You know, anyone that had done something in crypto went and convinced people that they should go start a VC fund and raise, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And we were sort of in this ZERP world and like anyone could have raised a VC fund at the time. And those guys raised these small funds. There are a handful there that are also actually excellent and they could be great fund managers, but there are a lot of them there that deployed capital, a little bit of it in 2021, 2022, but had dry powder and then didn't do anything in the bear market because there was not much any quality projects there, but are now feeling the pressure to just aggressively deploy because they can't go raise another fund if they're not fully deployed. So they're deploying, in my opinion, to a lot of bad projects just so they can go raise another fund.
And they want to say, oh, we allocated to this project, this hot project, even if the cost basis was like near all-time highs.
Yeah. And you kind of ask them, like, what's your thesis on the XYZ project? The thesis is not typically well articulated, other than there'll be a token at some point and we're in a bull market and I'll be able to exit the token, which to me is not a good investment case because that requires you to take for certainty that there is some bull market liquidity for you. And that's what you see a lot of VCs doing these days. And these are sort of the marginal guys that came in that last cycle that didn't get to really deploy. So that's kind of like the weird VC market structure I see.
Do you think there's a oversupply or a lot more VC funds than there are VC opportunities and a shortage of liquid token funds?
Potentially, yes. I mean, I'm kind of talking my book there, right? I mean, that's kind of the reason I run a liquid token strategy, because I think, you know, the token market is north of $2 trillion. Again, a decent chunk of that is Bitcoin. So if you take out Bitcoin and ETH and stable coins, the altcoin market is kind of in the $600 billion plus range. And my guess is the amount of directional institutional capital in that space is around $10 billion or so. So, you know, a vast majority of participants in this market are more retail and unfortunately less sophisticated, and they focus on a very specific category, as we said earlier, which is sort of these meme coins and narrative coins. So I think there's a lot of opportunity and white space in what I do. And there's a lot of sort of, you have kind of this opposite dynamic in the VC space, which you have a ton of managers, potentially with a decent amount of capital, and a lack of quality in terms of founders and projects that are coming to space.
Do you have a view on Solana, which really has led this cycle and, you know, is up a lot more than ETH, the Ethereum network? Do you have a view on that? What have you made of its rise? And it's a really, you know, resuscitation, if you could say that.
Yeah. So I came into the space using applications on Ethereum, right? Like ETH mainnet. Eventually, obviously, all these L2s started to come and I moved to these L2s and I tried different things on L2s personally. I think the user fragmentation thing is a real problem, or user experience fragmentation thing is a real problem in a variety of different ways. One is I have to be a sophisticated user at this moment to be able to bridge assets all over the place. But if also I'm a developer looking to build a project, I have too much choice at this moment when looking at the Ethereum ecosystem. Do I build on Optimism? Do I build on Arbitrum? Do I build on Starknet? There's so many L2s I can build on. And on top of that, these L2s are also making different choices, right? Some are using Ethereum for data availability. Some are using Celestia. Some are using EigenDA. So there's all these different choices like the developer has to make and the user has to make. And ultimately, that means you're kind of breaking composability. You're breaking this and you're creating this highly fragmented user experience. So my critique against the Ethereum ecosystem is they're less focused on the end user, which is all they should be focused on, because crypto's biggest problem is you have too many people who own crypto assets on an exchange and very few users on chain. And that has to be the key problem people have to solve. Solana has been hyper-focused on that, which is user experience. Like, how do we make this easy for end users? So when Solana runs up into a problem, their ideological solution is, let's try to reduce complexity while solving this problem. While the Ethereum's sort of solutions so far has been increasing complexity to solve scalability problems. So now, I'm not saying like there's an absolute sort of outcome here, because there are sort of these parallelized EVMs coming out. Monad is a big one everyone's talking about. And we wonder if one of these layer twos can also be a parallelized EVM and be sort of this winner-take-all layer two that becomes this focal point for the Ethereum ecosystem. So the game is not won, right? I'm not saying the game has been won. It's just I'm saying there's one ecosystem that cares about user experience at this moment more than the other.
Very interesting. What do you think about Eigenlayer?
A lot of hype. I would love to see what the use cases are. So it's clear that you can build up a massive amount of supply of staked Ethereum for restaking purposes and provide that restaked ETH for security. I would love to see what the use cases are to justify the hype. So who is going to use that restaked ETH? What are they willing to pay for that security? And how big is that market? And I think those are the big unknowns.
What do you think about crypto projects and protocols that attempt to do stuff in the artificial intelligence AI space, or at least market themselves? And which projects, how do you try and tell which, if any projects are, you know, legit versus, oh, AI is the hot new thing, I'll just start a new token called AI coin?
At this moment, I think most things in crypto and AI is nonsense. I think most of it doesn't really make any like business sense. I think the area that is interesting is maybe there's two kind of areas that are interesting to us. Number one is making the user experience for crypto users better. So simplistically, people want to communicate in natural language. So Jack, when you want to buy some NFT, you want to just be able to type, hey, take my ETH and buy me this NFT that might sit on Bitcoin or Solana or wherever. And it's better if some AI agents just do that for you rather than you sort of click a bunch of buttons and figure out how to do that yourself. Right. So you just want it to communicate to it in natural language and it does all these things in the back end. And there are some projects that are sort of doing that. We think that's an interesting area because we think, again, going back to one of the fundamental problems, 350 million people own crypto on some exchange, very few on-chain users. We think one of the biggest reasons for that is the user experience of being on-chain is not great. You have to like download a MetaMask wallet or some wallet, write down some private keys, and then still click buttons to do things. So I think having a language-based interface to do things on chain will potentially succeed. I need AI agents for that. So that's one area. The other area is around sort of this reinforcement learning thing, which is when you or I go and do things on ChatGPT or Claude or one of these large language models, we're helping that thing learn. And we should be getting paid for doing that, right? Like, these systems don't pay us for doing that. So if someone can pay users for reinforcement learning through sort of small micro payments with tokens, that's pretty interesting. I'm intrigued by that category.
You still are a believer in the promise of Web3 of people being able to own their own data and, being able to profit from and enjoy in the fruits of their data having value. What it was called Web3, definitely an overused term, but you still think that that is a serious use case that crypto can help with?
I think at its core, it makes sense, but no one's ever made a great product. So it's still like TBD whether it will happen. So if in my experience, they're oftentimes great ideas. It's just a matter of time when they can come to market and someone builds them and it works. So that second one of getting paid for like reinforcement learning, it's probably one of those things that's a great idea, but it's probably like years and years out.
Well, Pranav, it's been a pleasure talking with you on this fireside chat. People can find you on Twitter at Vanek, PK. There's PK, your initials. Where can people find more about your Substack as well as about the Vanek Digital Assets Alpha Fund?
So unfortunately, I cannot market the fund on a podcast. It's a QP-only fund, so I can't talk about it. But you can find my Substack at killerapps.substack.com. I haven't written in a while, but I should probably go back and write.
All right. Well, Pranav, thanks and talk soon.
Thank you.